or you'll blow your arm off. No one wants half a tattoo. A curious thing happened when the bottle left Ronan's hand. As it arced through the air, trails of fire orange in its wake, Ronan felt as if he had hurled his heart. There was a rip, just as he released it, and heat filling his body, pouring in through the hole he'd made. But now he could breathe, now that there was room in his suddenly light chest. The past was something that had happened to another version of himself, a version that could be lit and hurled away. Then the bottle landed in the driver's window of the Mitsubishi. It was as if there was no liquid, only fire. Flames poured across the headrest like a living thing. Cheers erupted across the fairground. Partygoers moved toward the car, moths to a new lamp. Ronan heaved a breath. Kavinsky, his laugh high and manic, dashed another bomb through the window. Prokopenko threw another. Now the interior was catching, and the smell was becoming toxic. Part of Ronan couldn't really believe the Mitsubishi was gone, but as the others began to add their cigarettes and drinks to the bonfire, the music abruptly vanished as the stereo melted. It seemed a vehicle was well and truly dead once the stereo had melted. "Skov!" shouted Kavinsky. "Music!" Another car's stereo boomed to life, taking up where the Mitsubishi had left off. Kavinsky turned to Ronan with a sly grin. "You coming the 4th of July this year?" Ronan exchanged a look with Gansey, but the other boy was looking out over the numerous silhouettes, his eyes narrowed. "Maybe," he replied.
"It's a lot like a substance party," Kavinsky said. "You want to see something explode? Bring something that explodes."
There was a dare there. It was a dare that could be satisfied maybe by a drive over the border or by the clever concoction of an explosive from plans found on the internet. But Ronan thought, with the same thrill he'd felt before, it was also one that he could attack with a dream. He was good at dangerous things, both in his sleep and while awake. "Maybe," he replied. Gansey was moving toward the BMW. "I'll light a candle for your car."
"You aren't leaving. Harsh."
If Gansey was going, Ronan was going. He paused long enough to flick another fake ID at Kavinsky's bare chest. "Stay out of our place."
Kavinsky's smile was wide and crooked. "I only come where they invite me, man."
"Lynch," Gansey said. "We're gone."
"That's right," Kavinsky called after Ronan. "Call your dog."
He said it like either Ronan or Gansey should be offended by it. But Ronan felt nothing but that fiery, empty cavern in his chest. He slid himself into the driver's seat as Gansey shut the passenger door. Ronan's phone buzzed in the door pocket. He looked at it. A message from Kavinsky.
"See you on the streets."
Dropping the phone back into the door, Ronan let the engine rev up high. He backed out with a dramatic spin in the dirt. Gansey made an approving noise. "Kavinsky," Gansey said with a little laugh in his voice, still dismissive. "He thinks he owns this place. He thinks life is a music video." He gripped the door as Ronan let the BMW have its head. The car galloped joyfully and recklessly toward home for a few miles, the speedometer setting the pace of their pulses. Ronan said, "You don't see the appeal?" Closing his eyes, Gansey leaned his head back on his seat, chin tilted up, throat green in the dash lights. There was still an unsafe sort of smile about his mouth. What a torment the possibility in that smile was. And he said, "There was never a time when that could have been you and me. You know the difference between us and Kavinsky? We matter." Just then, in that moment, the thought of Gansey leaving for D.C. without him was unbearable. They had been a two-headed creature for so long, Ronan and Gansey. He couldn't say it, though. There were 1,000 reasons why he couldn't say it. "While I'm gone," Gansey said, pausing, "dream me the world. Something new for every night." 28. "Good evening, King of Swords. And good evening, Noble Blade.
Did you do a reading before I came? To tell you how it all worked out? The gray man asked as he walked with Mara down toward the Champagne Mutiny. He had showered before he came, though he had not shaved his trademark grizzle from his jaw, and he looked nice, although Mara didn't point this out. Did you kill someone before you left to pick me up? Mara had traded her tattered blue jeans for a slightly less tattered pair of blue jeans and an off-the-shoulder cotton shirt that showed how well her collarbone and neck got along. She looked nice, although the gray man didn't point it out. But they were both aware that the other had noticed. Of course not. I don't think I kill nearly as many people as you think I do, he said, opening the passenger door for her. Do you know, this is the first time I've seen you wearing shoes. Oh, so what's going on there? Mara glanced over her shoulder to where he pointed. A small, weary Ford had just pulled up behind the gray man's rental car. Oh, that's Calla. She's following us to the restaurant to make sure you're really taking me there and not burying me in the woods. The gray man said, how ridiculous, I never bury anybody. Calla gave a mean-spirited wave in his general direction. Her fingers were claws on the steering wheel. She likes you, Mara said. You should be glad. She's a good friend to have. The tired Ford followed them to the restaurant and waited on the curb until the gray man and Mara were seated at a table beneath a honeysuckle and Christmas light-covered trellis. Fans fixed in the corners kept the humid night at bay. Mara said, I'm going to order for you. She waited to see if he would challenge her, but he just said, I'm allergic to strawberries. 6% of the population is, she noted. He said, I see where your daughter came from. She beamed at him. She had one of those lovely, open, perfect smiles, genuinely happy and very beautiful. The gray man thought, this is the worst decision I've ever made. She ordered for them. Neither drank any wine. The appetizers were delicious, not because of the kitchen, but because all food eaten in anticipation of a kiss is delicious. The gray man asked, what is it like being a seer? That's a funny way to put it. I only mean, how much do you see, and how clearly? Did you know I would ask that question? Do you know what I'm thinking? Mora's smile curled cleverly. It's like a dream, or a memory, but forward. Most of it is fuzzy, but sometimes we'll see one particular element very sharply, and it's not always the future. Oftentimes, when people come for a reading, we're really telling them things they already know. So no, I didn't know you would ask that question. And yes, I know what you're thinking, but that's because I'm a good guesser, not a good psychic. It was funny, the gray man thought, how humorous she always appeared, how that smile was always just a moment away from her lips. You really didn't see the sadness or the longing unless you already knew it was there. But that was the trick, wasn't it? Everyone had their disappointment and their baggage. Only some people carried it in their inside pockets and not on their backs. And here was the other trick. Mara was not faking her happiness. She was both very happy and very sad. Later, their entrees arrived. Mara had ordered the salmon for the gray man. Because, she said, there's something fishy about you. The gray man was amused. What's it like, being a hit man? That's a funny way to put it. But really, the gray man found that he didn't want to talk about his work. Not because he was ashamed of it, he was the best that he knew of, but because he was not defined by it. It wasn't what he did in his spare time. It pays the bills, but I prefer my poetry. Mara had ordered herself one of those small birds that was served looking like it had walked onto the plate under its own steam. She seemed to be doubting that decision now. Your old English poetry. Okay, I'll bite. Tell me why you like it. He did. He did it as well as he could without telling her about where he had gone to school or what he had done before publishing his book. He mentioned he had a brother, but quickly backtracked and moved around that part of the story. He told her as much as he could about himself without telling her his name. His phone was buzzing against his leg, but he let it ring. "So you are only a hitman to pay the rent," Mora said. "Do you not care about hurting people?" The gray man considered. He didn't want to be untruthful. "I do," he said. "I just turned that part of my brain off." Mora pulled one of the legs off her tiny bird. "I don't suppose I have to tell you how psychologically unhealthy that is." "There are more destructive impulses in the world," he replied. "I feel fairly balanced." "What about you and your ambition?" Her eyes widened in surprise. "What makes you say that?" "The game you were playing that first night, when you were guessing the cards, practicing, experimenting." "I just want to understand it," Mora said. "It's changed my entire life. It's a waste if I don't know as much as I can. I don't know if I'd call it ambition, though." "Oh, I don't know. It has done its damage." "So you mentioned a brother." She somehow managed to link the word brother to damage. He felt as if she had already divined the nuances of their relationship. "My brother," he said, and then he paused and regrouped. "Very precisely," he replied. "My brother is very intelligent. He can create a map of a place if he's driven through it once. He can do great sums in his head. I always looked up to him when I was a child. He invented complicated games and spent all day at them. Sometimes he would include me if I promised to follow the rules. Sometimes he'd take a game like chess or Risk and apply those rules to the entire neighborhood. Sometimes we built forts and hid in them. Sometimes he found things in other people's houses and hurt me with them. Sometimes he trapped animals and did things to them. Sometimes we dressed in costumes and put on plays." Mora pushed her plate away. "So he was a sociopath?" "Probably, yes." She sighed. It was a very sad sigh. "And now you're a hitman. What does he do? Is he in prison?" The gray man said, "He invests other people's money in SEP accounts. He will never be in prison. He's too intelligent."
"And you?"
"I don't think I would do well in prison," he said. "I would rather not go." Mora was quiet for a very long time. Then she folded her napkin and put it aside and leaned to him.
"Does it bother you that he's made you this way? You know that's why you can do this, don't you?"
Any part of the gray man that had been bothered by this had died a long time before, burned with matches and gashed with scissors and picked at with straight pins, and when he looked at her, he didn't disguise that deadness in him.
"Oh," she said. Reaching across the table, she laid her palm on his cheek. It was cool and soft and entirely different somehow from what the gray man had expected. More real. Much more real. "I'm sorry no one saved you."
Was he unsaved? Would he have ever ended up any other way? Mora called for the check. The gray man paid for it. He'd left two bites of salmon on his plate, and Mora used her fork to steal them.
"So we'll both have fish breath," she said.
And then, in the dark, next to the champagne travesty, he kissed her. Neither of them had kissed someone else in a while, but it didn't much matter. Kissing's a lot like laughing. If the joke's funny, it doesn't matter how long it's been since you last heard one. Finally, she murmured, her hand in his shirt, fingers tracing ribs,
"This is a terrible idea."
"There aren't terrible ideas," the gray man said. "Just ideas done terribly."
"That's also a psychologically unhealthy concept."
Later, after he dropped her off and returned back to the Pleasant Valley bed and breakfast, he discovered that Shorty and Patty Wetzel had been trying desperately to call him all through dinner to let him know that his rooms at the bed and breakfast had been ransacked. "Didn't you hear us calling?" Patty asked urgently. The gray man recalled the buzz of his phone and patted his pockets. His phone was missing, however. Morris Sargent had stolen it while they were making out. In its place was the Ten of Swords.
the gray man slain on the ground, and Mora the sword driven through his heart.
29.
You aren't sleeping, Persephone said as she woke Blue, so would you come help us?
Blue opened her eyes. Her mouth was pasted shut. A fan in the corner of the room rotated back and forth, drying sweat on the backs of her knees. Persephone knelt on the edge of her bed, draping a crimped pale cloud of hair around Blue's face. She smelled of roses and masking tape. The sky outside was black and blue.
I was, in her tiny voice Persephone pointed out, but you aren't now.
There was absolutely no point in arguing with her. It was like fighting with a cat. Also, it wasn't strictly untrue. With an irritable stretch, she kicked Persephone off her bed and tossed off her sheet. Together, they padded down the midnight stairs into the musty glow of the kitchen. Mora and Calla were already there, hunched over the table like a pair of conspirators, heads close together. The fake Tiffany lamp above them painted the backs of their heads in purple and orange. The night pressed in the glass door at their back. Blue could see the familiar, comforting silhouette of the beech tree in the yard. At the sound of Blue's footfalls, Mora looked up.
Oh, good.
Blue gave her mother a heavy look. Do I have time to make myself some tea? Mora flapped her hand. By the time Blue joined them at the table with her cup, all three women were drawn over a single object. One blonde head, one brunette, one black. Three people, but one entity. Blue shivered a little as she sat down.
Oh, mint tea, Calla said meaningfully, ruining the mood. Rolling her eyes, Blue asked, what is it I'm helping with?
They opened their ranks enough for her to see what they clustered around, a cell phone. It was cupped in Calla's hand. Clearly they'd been trying to get her reading on it.
This is Mr. Gray's, Mora said. Will you help us?
Wearily, Blue placed her hand on Calla's shoulder.
No, Mora said. Not like that. We're trying to figure out how to access his email.
Oh, she accepted the phone.
Kids these days.
I know, right? Blue thumbed through the screens. Though she had no cell phone of her own, she had handled them plenty, and this was the same model as Gansey's. It took no particular skill to open Mr. Gray's email. She handed it back. The three women leaned in.
Did you steal that?
Blue asked. There was no answer. Their necks were all craned, looking.
Shall I light some orris and celery?
Persephone blinked up, her black eyes a little far away.
Oh, yes, please.
With a yawn, Blue pushed up from the table and prepared a little plate of celery seed and orris root from the cabinet. She used one of the candles on the counter to light it, or sort of light it. The mixture smoked and popped, the celery seeds twitching like popcorn and the orris root smelling of burning violets. The smoke of them was meant to clarify psychic impressions. She set the plate down on the table between them. It had begun to smell a little like fireworks.
So why are you going through his phone?
We all knew he was looking for something, Mora replied. We just didn't know what.
Now we know what.
And what is that?
Your snake boy, Calla said. Only he doesn't know it's a boy.
Mora said, he calls it the Gray Warren and says it's to take things out of dreams.
You're going to have to be careful, Blue. I think that family is all tangled up in something messy.
Something messy that involved Ronan's father being beaten to death with a tire iron. That part Blue already knew.
Do you think he's dangerous to Ronan?
Blue remembered Declan Lynch's battered face.
I mean, if he finds out that the Grey Warren is a he and not an it?
Calla said, absolutely, at the same time that Mora said, probably not.
Persephone and Calla shot looks at Mora.
I'll take that as a maybe, Blue said.
At that moment, the phone leapt from the table surface. All four of them jumped. Blue was the first to calm. It was only ringing, or rather buzzing and vibrating its way across the table.
Write down the number,
Calla called, but she must have been talking to herself because she already was. In a small voice, Persephone said,
it's a Henrietta number. Do you want to pick it up?
Mora shook her head. After a moment,
A voicemail buzzed through. That we'll listen to, though. Blue, make it work?
Shaking her head, Blue swiped the phone and thumbed to the voicemail. She handed it to Mora.
Oh, Mora said, listening. It's him. Do I push this button to call him back? Yes. She waited as the phone rang and then... Ah, hello, Mr. Gray.
Blue loved that voice of her mother's, except for when it was being used on her. It was her authoritative, cheerful voice, the one that said she had all of the cards. Only now she was using it on a hitman whose phone she had just stolen. Blue couldn't decide if this was delightfully cheeky or incredibly foolish.
Well, you didn't think I was going to answer a call on your phone, did you?
That would be awfully rude.
Did you get home all right?
Oh, yes, you can have it back now.
I'm sorry if you needed it.
Did you...
Oh.
Whatever the gray man had said immediately shut Mora up. She dropped her eyes from the others and sucked her upper lip between her teeth. The tips of her ears were pink. She listened for a moment, swatting Calla and Persephone back.
Well, she said finally, any time.
I'd say that you should call first, but...
Well, you know. I have your phone.
Ha.
All right.
All right.
Don't sleep on your back. All the swords will go through to the other side.
Yep, that's my professional advice.
Mora pressed end.
What did he say? Blue demanded.
That we might as well just ask him which valuables we wanted from him next so he could plan for their absence, Mora said.
Calla's lips pursed. Is that all?
Mora busied herself moving the phone from her left hand to her right and back to her left.
Oh, just that he had a nice time at dinner.
Blue burst out. But you haven't forgotten Butternut.
Her mother didn't protest the name for once. She said,
I never do.
30. That night, Ronan dreamt of his tattoo. He had gotten the spreading, intricate tattoo only months before, a little to irritate Declan, a little to see if it was really as bad as everyone said, and definitely so everyone who glimpsed the hooks of it had fair warning. It was full of things from his head. Beaks and claws and flowers and vines stuffed into screaming mouths. It took him a long time to fall asleep that night. His thoughts crowded with the burning Mitsubishi, Gansey holding the Molotov cocktail, the enigmatic language on the puzzle box, the dark bags beneath Adam's eyes. And when he fell asleep, he dreamt of the tattoo. Ordinarily, Ronan only saw bits and pieces of it. He had not seen the full design since he'd gotten it. But tonight, he saw the tattoo itself. From behind, as if he was outside of his own body, as if it was apart from his body. It was more complicated than he remembered. The road to the barns was threaded through it, and Chainsaw peered out from a thicket of thorns. Adam was in the dream, too. He traced the tangled pattern of the ink with his finger. He said, "Skill quid hoc est." As he traced it farther and farther down on the bare skin of Ronan's back, Ronan himself disappeared entirely, and the tattoo got smaller and smaller. It was a Celtic knot the size of a wafer, and then Adam, who had become Kavinsky, said, "Scio, quid estis vos?" He put the tattoo in his mouth and swallowed it. Ronan woke with a start, ashamed and euphoric. The euphoria wore off long before the shame did. He was never sleeping again.
31. The next morning, Helen came in the helicopter for Gansey and Adam. As they took off, Adam leaned his head in his hands, his eyes glassily terrified, and Gansey, ordinarily a fan of flying, tried to be sympathetic. His head was a tumble of burning cars and ancient Camaro wheels and the deconstruction of everything Blue had said to him. Below, he could still see Ronan where he lay on the roof of the BMW watching them ascend. It felt ridiculous to leave Henrietta, the epicenter of the universe, for his parents' house. As they sailed up and over the roof of Monmouth, Gansey caught a last image of Ronan sarcastically blowing him a kiss before turning his head away. The rest of the flight left no time for introspection, however. Helen handed Gansey her phone and spent the entire flight dictating texts to him through the headphones. It was impossible for Gansey to consider what they'd do about Cabe's water when Helen's voice sounded directly in his head. "Tell her the centerpieces are in the garage. The bay farthest away from the house. Of course not where the Adenauer's parked. Do I look like an idiot? Don't type that. What does she say now? The extra champagne flutes are being delivered by Chelsea. Tell her if the cheese isn't in the fridge, I don't know where it is. Don't you have Beach's cell phone? Of course I know what a vegan is. Tell her they have to use olive oil instead of butter. Because cows make butter and Italians make olive oil. Fine. Tell her I will pick her up some vegan hors d'oeuvres. Vegans vote too. Don't type that." If Gansey hadn't guessed the scope of the party, he would have gotten all the clues he needed during the flight. Of course, it wasn't just the party this evening. There was also the tea party the next morning and the book club speech the day after that. Adam looked as if he might throw up. Gansey wanted badly to tell him that he would be all right, but there was no way to be confidential with the headsets on. Adam would have been mortified for Helen to know how nervous he was. Just 45 minutes later, Helen landed the helicopter at the airfield and transferred herself, her overnight bag, the boys, and their suit bags to her silver Audi. Gansey felt vaguely shell-shocked to be back in Northern Virginia, like he'd never left. The sun seemed more unforgiving on the backs of all the clean, new cars, and the air through the vents smelled like exhaust and someone else's cooking. Numerous archipelagos of stores thrust through seas of asphalt. It seemed like there were brake lights everywhere, but nothing was actually motionless. Questing for hors d'oeuvres, Helen managed to find parking at the very back of the Whole Foods lot. She swiveled to face Gansey and Adam. "Do you want to come in and help me?" They stared at her. "What a royal shock. I'll leave it running," she said. As soon as she'd shut the door, Gansey swiveled in the passenger seat to face Adam in the back, resting his cheek against the cool leather headrest. "How are you doing?" Adam had melted across the length of the back seat. He said, "Praying I haven't grown since last year." Gansey had gone with Adam to get fitted for a suit the winter before. He said, "I tried mine on before we left. I don't think you're any taller. It's only been a few months." Adam closed his eyes. "You'll be okay. Don't talk to me about it. I can't." Adam slithered down even farther so that he lay on the seat and let his legs rest against the opposite door. "Talk about something else." "What else is there to talk about?" "Blue." He didn't say anything. "Knock it off, Gansey," Adam said. "Mallory? Did he ever get back to you?" He hadn't. Gansey dialed Mallory's number. He heard the tinny double ring of a UK number, and then Mallory answered. "What?" He sounded confused that his phone had accepted a call. There was a tremendous amount of undefined background noise. "It's Gansey. Is this a bad time?" "No, no, 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 no." Putting the phone on speaker, Gansey slid it onto the dash. "Did you have any more thoughts by any chance?" "No? Well, we have a new problem." "What's the trouble?" he told him. "Give me a moment to think," Mallory said. Commotion hummed on the line. A dreadful shriek rang out. "What in the world is that noise?" "Birds, Gansey. The king of birds." Gansey exchanged a look with Adam. "An eagle?" "Don't be blasphemous. Pigeons. It's the regional today. I used to show them myself, you know. Don't have the time these days, but I still love the look of a quality Verberg shield cropper," Gansey said. "A pigeon show." "If you could see them, Gansey." On his end of the line, a loudspeaker blared. Adam's mouth corked. Gansey prompted, "The Verberg shield croppers." "There is so much more on offer here," Mallory replied. "Much more than the croppers." "Tell me what you are looking at right now." Mallory smacked his lips. He was really the absolute worst human to speak to on the telephone and considered, "I'm looking at..."
What does this seem to be? The West of England tumbler, I should think. Yes, lovely example. You should see his muffs. Right next to him is a dreadful little Thuringian field pigeon. I've never had them, but I'm quite certain they aren't meant to have that hideous stallion neck. I have no idea what this one is. Let's read the card. Anatolian ringbeater. Of course. Oh, and here's a German beauty homer.
Oh, those are my favorite, Gansey said. I'm a fan of a good German beauty homer.
Gansey, don't make light, Mallory said sternly. Those things look like bloody puffins.
Adam's body shook in silent convulsions of laughter. Gansey took a moment to catch his breath before asking,
And what's that sound in the background?
Let me take a gander, Mallory replied.
There was a crackling sound, and then his voice, rather louder than before, said,
They're auctioning off some beds!
What sort? Please tell me, German beauty homers. Adam, completely undone, bit his hand. Small gasps still managed to escape.
Pygmy pouters, Mallory replied. Feisty ones.
Gansey mouthed, blue, at Adam. Adam let out a little wail of helpless laughter.
You never took me to any pigeon shows while I was there, Gansey said reproachfully.
We had other tasks at hand, Gansey, Mallory said, such as now. This is what I think about your ley line. I think your forest is like an apparition. If I had to guess about these things, without a solid source of energy, an apparition can only flicker.
But we woke the ley line, replied Gansey. It's so strong sometimes that it blows out the transformers here.
Ah, but you said that the electricity goes out as well, did you not?
Gansey grudgingly agreed, and now he was thinking of Noah vanishing in the Dollar City.
So you see how your forest might be starved as well as overfed.
Good heavens, man! Would you watch where you're carrying that thing?
Sorry, I should think you are. I'd be sorry, too, if I had to claim that monstrosity as my own. That sausage neck! Excuse you!
There was a scuffle, and then Mallory said,
I apologize, Gansey. Some people. I should think you need to find out how to stabilize your line. The surges, I'd expect, but certainly not the outages.
Any ideas?
I've had quite a lot of ideas in just the last minute, Mallory said. I should like to see this line of yours. Are you opposed one day?
You're welcome any time, Gansey said, and meant it. For all his faults, Mallory was still Gansey's oldest ally. He had earned it.
Excellent, excellent. Now, if you don't mind, Mallory said, I have just spotted a pair of shield croppers.
They exchanged goodbyes. Gansey turned his eyes to Adam, who looked more like himself than he had in ages. He silently vowed to do whatever it took to keep him that way.
Well, I don't know how helpful that was, Adam said.
We found out German beauty homers look like bloody puffins.
The very first thing Ronan did after Gansey left was retrieve the keys to the Camaro. He had no immediate plan other than to see if they actually fit into the lock. In the summer sun, the pig glistened like a gem in the scrubby grass and gravel. Ronan lay a hand on the rear panel and slid his palm lightly up over the roof. Even that felt illicit. This car was so much Gansey's that it seemed as if somewhere Gansey must be able to feel this minor transgression. When Ronan lifted his hand, it was dusted green. He was struck by the details of the moment. This was something he needed to remember when he dreamt. This feeling right here. Heart thudding, pollen sticky on his fingertips, July pricking sweat at his breastbone. The smell of gasoline and someone else's charcoal grill. Every blade of grass was picked out in sharp detail. If Ronan could dream like this moment felt, he could take anything out. He could take this whole goddamn car out. He put the key in the door. It fit. He turned it. The lock popped up. A smile was working over his mouth, though there was no one to see it, especially because there was no one to see it. Ronan sank into the driver's seat. The vinyl was infernally hot in the sun, but he just filed that information away. It was yet another sensation that made the moment real instead of a dream. Slowly, he ran a finger around the thin steering wheel, rested his palm on the slick gear shift. Gansey's heart would stop if he saw Ronan Lynch right here. Unless the key didn't work in the ignition. Ronan put his feet on the clutch and brake, inserted the key, and turned it. The engine roared to life. Ronan grinned. On cue, his phone buzzed as a text message came in. He slid it out of his pocket. Kavinsky.
My new wheels will blow you away. See you tonight at 11.
An hour later, Noah let Blue into Monmouth Manufacturing. The sun had made the space vast and musty and lovely. The warm, trapped air was scented with old wood and mint and 10,000 pages about Glendower. Although Gansey had been gone only hours, it suddenly seemed longer, like this was all that was left of him.
"Where's Ronan?" she whispered as Noah closed the door behind her. "Making trouble," Noah whispered back.
It was strange to be here without anyone else. Speaking felt a little forbidden.
"Nothing we can do anything about."
"Are you sure?" Blue murmured. "I can do a lot of things."
"Not about this."
She hesitated by the door. It felt like trespassing without Gansey or Ronan here. What she wanted was to somehow stuff all of Monmouth Manufacturing inside her head and keep it there. She was struck with anxious longing. Noah held his hand out. She accepted it. It was bone cold, as always, and together they turned to face the huge room. Noah took a deep breath, as if they were preparing to explore the jungle instead of stepping deeper into Monmouth Manufacturing. It seemed bigger, with just the two of them there. The cobwebbed ceiling soared, dust motes making mobiles overhead. They turned their heads sideways and read the titles of the books aloud. Blue peered at Henrietta through the telescope. Noah daringly reattached one of the broken miniature roofs on Gansey's scale town. They went through the fridge tucked in the bathroom. Blue selected a soda. Noah took a plastic spoon. He chewed on it as Blue fed Chainsaw leftover hamburger. They closed Ronan's door. If Gansey still managed to inhabit the rest of the apartment, Ronan's presence was still decidedly pervasive in his room. Noah showed Blue his room. They jumped on his perfectly made bed and then they played a bad game of pool. Noah lounged on the new sofa while Blue persuaded the old record player to play an LP too clever to interest either of them. They opened all of the drawers on the desk in the main room. One of Gansey's EpiPens bounced against the interior of the topmost drawer as Blue withdrew a fancy pen. She copied Gansey's blocky handwriting onto a Nino's receipt as Noah put on a preppy sweater he'd found balled under the desk. She ate a mint leaf and breathed on Noah's face. Crouching, they crab-walked along the aerial printout Gansey had spread the length of the room. He'd jotted enigmatic notes to himself all along the margin of it. Some of them were coordinates. Some of them were explanations of topography. Some of them were Beatles lyrics. Finally, they regarded Gansey's bed, which was just a barely made mattress and box spring on a metal stand. It sat in a square of sunlight in the middle of the room, turned at an angle as if it had been driven into the building. Without any particular discussion, they curled on top of the blanket, each taking one of Gansey's pillows. It felt illicit and drowsy. Only inches away, Noah blinked sleepily at her. Blue crumpled the edge of the sheet against her nose. It smelled like mint and wheatgrass, which was to say, like Gansey. As they baked in the sunlight, she let herself think it. "I have a crush on Richard Gansey. In a way, it was easier than pretending otherwise. She couldn't do anything about it, of course, but letting herself think it was like popping a blister. Of course, the opposite truth also seemed self-evident. I don't have a crush on Adam Parrish. She sighed. Noah, his voice muffled, said, "Sometimes I pretend I'm like him." "What part?" he considered. "Alive." Blue draped an arm over his cold neck. There wasn't really anything to say to make being dead better. For a few sleepy minutes, they were silent, nested in the pillows, and then Noah said, "I heard about how you won't kiss Adam." She turned her face into the pillow, cheeks hot. "Well, I don't care," Noah said. With quiet delight, he guessed. "He smells, right?" She turned back to him. "He does not smell. Ever since I was little, every psychic I know has told me that if I kiss my true love, he'll die." Noah's brow furrowed, or at least the half of it that wasn't buried in pillow. His nose was more crooked than she'd ever noticed. "Adam's your true love?" "No," Blue said. She was startled by how quickly she had answered. She couldn't stop seeing the dented side of the box he'd kicked. "I mean, I don't know. I just don't kiss anybody just to be on the safe side." Being dead made Noah more open-minded than most, so he didn't bother with doubt. "Is it when or if?" "What do you mean?" "Like, if you kiss your true love, he'll die?" he said. "Or is it when you kiss your true love, he'll die?" "I don't get what the difference is." He rubbed the side of his face on the pillow. Soft, he remarked, then added, "One's your fault. The other one, you just happen to be there when it happens. Like when you kiss him, pow, he gets hit by a bear. Totally not your fault. You shouldn't feel bad about that. It's not your bear." "I think it's if. They all say if." "Bummer. So you're never going to kiss anyone?" "Looks that way." Noah rubbed the smudge on his cheek. It didn't go away. It never did. He said, "I know somebody you could kiss."
"Who?"
She realized his eyes were amused. "Oh, wait." He shrugged. He was maybe the only person Blue knew who could preserve the integrity of a shrug while lying down. "It's not like you're going to kill me. I mean, if you were curious." She hadn't thought she was curious. It hadn't been an option, after all. Not being able to kiss someone was a lot like being poor. She tried not to dwell on the things she couldn't have. But now...
"Okay," she said.
"What?"
"I said okay."
He blushed. Or rather, because he was dead, he became normal-colored. He propped himself on an elbow.
"Well," she unburied her face from the pillow. "Just... like..."
He leaned toward her. Blue felt a thrill for a half a second, no, more like a quarter second, because after that she felt the too firm pucker of his tense lips. His mouth mashed her lips until it met teeth. The entire thing was at once slimy and ticklish and hilarious. They both gasped an embarrassed laugh. Noah said, "Bah!" Blue considered wiping her mouth, but felt that would be rude. It was all fairly underwhelming. She said, "Well..." "Wait," Noah replied. "Wait, wait, wait." He pulled one of Blue's hairs out of his mouth. "I wasn't ready." He shook out his hands as if Blue's lips were a sporting event and cramping was a very real possibility.
"Go,"
Blue said. This time, they only got within a breath of each other's lips when they both began to laugh. She closed the distance and was rewarded with another kiss that felt a lot like kissing a dishwasher. "I'm doing something wrong," she suggested.
"Sometimes it's better with tongue," he replied dubiously.
They regarded each other. Blue squinted.
"Are you sure you've done this before?"
"Hey," he protested. "It's weird for me because it's you."
"Well, it's weird for me because it's you.
We can stop."
"Maybe we should."
Noah pushed himself up farther on his elbow and gazed at the ceiling vaguely. Finally, he dropped his eyes back to her.
You've seen, like, movies of kisses, right? Your lips need to be, like, wanting to be kissed. Blue touched her mouth. What are they doing now? Like, bracing themselves. She pursed and unpursed her lips. She saw his point. So imagine one of those, Noah suggested. She sighed and sifted through her memories until she found one that would do. It wasn't a movie kiss, however. It was the kiss the Dreaming Tree had showed her in Caveswater. Her first and only kiss with Gansey, right before he died. She thought about his nice mouth when he smiled, about his pleasant eyes when he laughed. She closed her eyes. Placing an elbow on the other side of her head, Noah leaned close and kissed her once more. This time, it was more of a thought than a feeling, a soft heat that began at her mouth and unfurled through the rest of her. One of his cold hands slid behind her neck and he kissed her again, lips parted. It was not just a touch, an action. It was a simplification of both of them. They were no longer Noah Cherney and Blue Sargent. They were now just him and her. Not even that. They were only the time that they held between them. Oh, thought Blue, so this is what I can't have. Not being able to kiss whoever she fell in love with didn't feel so different from not having a cell phone when everyone else at school did. It didn't feel very different from knowing she wasn't going to be studying ecology abroad for college or going abroad, period. It didn't feel very different from knowing that Caveswater was going to be the only extraordinary thing about her life. Which was to say that it was unbearable, but she had to bear it anyway. Because there was nothing terrible about kissing Noah Cherney apart from him being cold. She let him kiss her and kissed him back until he pulled back on an elbow and clumsily wiped away some of her tears with the heel of his fist. His smudge had gotten very dark, and he was cold enough that she shivered. Blue gave him a watery smile. That was super nice. He shrugged, eyes doleful, shoulders curled in on themselves. He was fading. It wasn't that she could see through him. It was that it was hard to remember what he looked like, even while she was looking at him. When he turned his head, she saw him swallow. He mumbled, "I'd ask you out if I was alive." Nothing was fair. "I'd say okay," she replied. She only had time to see him smile faintly, and then he was gone. She rolled onto her back in the middle of the suddenly empty bed. Above her, the rafters glowed with the summer sun. Blue touched her mouth. It felt the same as it always did. Not at all like she had just gotten her first and last kiss.
32.
"Get in," Ronan said.
"Where are we going?" asked Matthew, but he was already climbing in, throwing his bag in the back. He shut the door. The interior of the car instantly smelled like a cologne sample. Ronan put the BMW in gear. Aglenby shrank in the rearview mirror. "Home."
"Home?"
yelped Matthew. Clutching the door handle, he stared over his shoulder as if bystanders would divine their destination.
"Ronan, we can't," Declan said.
Ronan slammed on the brakes. The tires squealed obligingly, and the car jerked to a halt by the sidewalk. The car behind them honked and went around.
"You can get out here and walk back if you want, but I'm going. Do you want to or not?"
His younger brother's already round eyes were even rounder.
"Declan..."
"Don't say his name."
Little dimples appeared in Matthew's chin, the sort that had meant when he was 3 or 4 that he was going to cry. He did not cry.
Ronan wished for a half a second that he didn't hate Declan for Matthew's sake.
"Okay," Matthew said. "Are you sure we'll be okay?"
"No," Ronan replied, because he always told the truth. Matthew put on his seatbelt. Ronan rummaged through his MP3 player until he found a playlist of bouzouki music. Matthew hadn't played since Neil Lynch died, but he'd been pretty good at it before then. It felt indulgent.
Ronan rationed the music from their old life, as if he used up a bit of his memories of his father every time he played it. Surely this occasion warranted it, though. As the tune plucked through the speakers, his younger brother let all of the air escape from his lungs, and Ronan drove home for the second time. This time felt different. Having Matthew along should have made returning to the barns feel more familiar than before, but instead it only served to remind Ronan of how forbidden this was. The sunshine made it a more anxious trip as well, as if the bright light left them more exposed as they drove down the driveway. Ronan went slowly until he verified that the home nurse's car wasn't there, and then he drove around the back of the house to where an overgrown, mildew-green equipment shed stood. "Open that door," he ordered Matthew. "Hurry up." Matthew scrambled out, pawed away some of the creeper, and struggled to lift the metal door. He dragged a small, rusted lawnmower out of the way, and Ronan backed the BMW in. He turned it off, pulled down the door again, and checked to be sure the tires hadn't left obvious marks. "James Bond," Matthew remarked inexplicably. He was incredibly cheerful. "What's that?" Ronan held the puzzle box under his arm. "A shoebox." Matthew cocked his head, working this out. He took in the facts. The perfectly square box was clearly wooden, covered with strange markings, and several inches shorter than his older brother's feet. Matthew blinked. Then he said, "Okay." Trotting ahead to the back door, he found the key hidden by the boot pull. "Wait," Ronan warned. "Keep an ear out. If someone comes down the driveway, get in the basement and turn off your phone, for God's sake." "Right. Sure. Clever." He galumphed into the house before Ronan, who looked over his shoulder before he locked the back door behind them. He heard Matthew's feet head toward the sitting room, hesitate, and then pound percussively up the stairs to his bedroom. Matthew's affection was a sloppy, demonstrative thing, and he had not seemed to know what to make of their now motionless mother. Ronan followed the hall to the sitting room more slowly, listening for the sounds of an approaching car between each footfall. The sitting room was dimmer and quieter than the hall, with no windows to let in the simmering afternoon or the trilling birds. The door to the basement was on the far wall, so he'd be able to intercept Matthew if anyone else arrived. Ronan went directly to the desk against the wall, not looking at his mother. His father had called this desk his office, as if his work had required a legitimate form of paperwork. Ronan wondered if his mother had known what Neil Lynch did for a living. Surely she must have. She must have known she was a dream thing. Suddenly, for the briefest of moments, panic forced itself up. Am I a dream creature? Would I know? Then he let reason tamp the thought down. All of the boys had baby books with photos and hospital records. He had a blood type, and if his father had dreamt him, he'd be motionless like his mother. He had been born, not conjured. He was real. What is real? Was something real once it had been taken from a dream? If so, was it real the moment he thought it? He stole a glance over his shoulder at his mother. She didn't seem particularly logical now, sitting motionless and uncaring for months and months. But he had never doubted her before her father's death, even when she was the only parent for months at a time. She's nothing without Dad. Declan was wrong. She existed apart from Neil Lynch, even if he was her sole creator. Ronan turned back to the desk. Setting the puzzle box on it, he pulled open the main drawer. A copy of his father's will sat on the very top of the contents, just as he remembered it. Not bothering to reread the earlier clauses of the document, they would only anger him, he flipped directly to the last page. There, right before his father's signature, "Neil Lynch was, at the time of so executing said will, of sound mind, memory, and understanding, and not under any restraint or in any respect incompetent to make a will. This will stands as fact unless a newer document is created. Signed this day, T. Libre, Vero Abar, Nivo, Libre, Nacre." Ronan squinted at the final phrase.
Picking up the puzzle box, he turned it around until the side with the unknown language faced him. It was painstaking work to plug in each word. Though he couldn't understand how the box managed it, it held the previously entered words in its workings in order to translate the grammar as well. That was how it had worked in the dream, after all. If it worked in the dream, it worked in real life. He frowned at the translation it provided.
"This will stands as fact unless a newer document is created."
Pressing his finger on the paper to keep his place, he compared it. Sure enough, the translated sentence was identical to the final sentence in English. But why would his father write the same thing in two different languages? Hope, he hadn't realized what the feeling was until it abandoned him, slowly trailed out of him. He'd been right about the language, but wrong that there was a secret message. Or if it was a secret message, he wasn't clever enough to decode it. Ronan shoved the drawer shut and folded the will into his back pocket to take with him. Just as he turned with the puzzle box, Matthew appeared in the doorway. He arrived with such speed that his shoulder crashed into the door jamb. "Nice," Ronan said thinly. Matthew waved a hand and panted, voice low, "I think someone's here." They both looked behind them at the basement door. Ronan asked, "What kind of car?" Matthew shook his head wildly. "In the house!" It was impossible, but the hair on Ronan's neck crept up. And then he heard it, distantly, from somewhere else in the house. Tick, 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 tick. The night horror. Ronan didn't think. He threw himself across the room and dragged Matthew inside. There was a slow scrape from the direction of the kitchen.
"Basement?" gulped Matthew, shocked.
Ronan didn't answer. He shoved closed the sitting room door and looked wildly around.
"Chair," he hissed at his younger brother. "Hurry!"
Matthew cast about before carrying a flimsy, armless chair over. Ronan tried to work out a door jamb, but the old-fashioned door hook resisted his efforts. Even if it had been an ordinary knob, the chair wasn't tall enough to provide a whisper of leverage.
"Tick, tick, tick, tick." "Ronan!"
Matthew whispered. Ronan leapt over three old flower crocks to where a cedar chest was pressed against the wall. He tested the weight and then began to shove.
"Come on, help me," he grunted.
Matthew skidded over and threw his shoulder against it. The claws tapped on the hallway floorboards, scuffling. The cedar chest scraped to a halt in front of the door. Back in Monmouth, the bookshelf had been heavy enough to keep the night horror in his bedroom. Ronan could only hope that the chest would be as effective. Matthew looked up at Ronan, bewildered, as his older brother climbed on top of the cedar chest. Ronan stretched out an arm and hugged his brother's curly head once hard. He pushed him away.
"Sit next to Mom," he hissed. "It doesn't want you. It's me.
Ro,
but if it gets past me, don't wait. Just fight."
Matthew retreated to where Aurora Lynch sat on her chair in the middle of the room, tranquil and motionless. Ronan saw him crouched there in the dim space holding their mother's hand. He should have never brought him with. The door bucked. Matthew jerked in surprise. Aurora didn't. Ronan held the doorknob as it jiggled. There was a slow sound like water tapping out of a faucet. The door jumped again. Again Matthew started, but the cedar chest didn't budge. It was heavy, and the night horror was not. Its strength was in those claws and that beak. Three more times the door jerked on its hinges. Then there was a long, long pause. It was possible. It had given up. But Ronan hadn't considered what their next step would be. They couldn't risk opening the door if the night horror was on the other side. Perhaps he should go out by himself. The bird men never wanted anyone else. It was only Ronan they despised. Everything in him was loath to leave his brother and mother behind, but they would both be safer without him. Long minutes stretched out in silence, and then, somewhere in the house, a door shut. Matthew and Ronan stared at each other. Something about the sound had been very unhurried and human, not at all what Ronan would have expected from the night horror. Sure enough, ordinary footsteps began to creak down the hall. Possibilities unwound in Ronan's mind, none of them good. There was no time to move the cedar chest without drawing attention to it. No wisdom to warning this newcomer of the nightmare, either. Ronan's presence would only make it more dangerous.
Hide, Ronan ordered Matthew.
His younger brother was frozen, so he grabbed his sleeve and tugged him away from their mother. There was just room for them to tuck themselves behind the rolled-up rugs in the corner of the room. It wouldn't withstand careful study, but in the dimness, there was no reason why they'd be discovered. Many minutes later, after much creaking of floorboards elsewhere in the house, someone gave the door an experimental shove. This time, it was quite clearly a someone rather than a something. There was an audible, human-sounding sigh on the other side, and the shuffling of feet on the floorboards was clearly produced by shoes. Ronan held a finger to his lips. There was only one more shove, and then the door cracked an inch. Another grunt, another shove, and the door came open far enough to admit a person. Ronan wasn't sure who he had expected. The home nurse, probably. Maybe even Declan, visiting illegally. But this was a handsome, wiry man all dressed in gray. Ronan had never seen him before. The way he flicked his gaze around the room was so keen, Ronan was afraid he would see them behind the rugs after all. But the man's interest was snagged by Aurora Lynch on her chair in the middle of the room. Ronan tensed. It would take nothing at all to spring him from his hiding place if he so much as touched her. But the gray man didn't touch Aurora. Instead, he bent over to look into her face. It was a curious, piercing study over in a few seconds. He towed the tubes and wires that led from machines to nowhere. He rubbed his jaw and puzzled. Finally, the gray man asked, "Why are you walled up in here?" Aurora Lynch didn't answer. The gray man turned to go but paused. The language box still sitting on the desk had caught his eye. Retrieving the box, he turned it over and over in his hands, experimentally scrolling one of the wheels and watching the effect it had on the other sides. And then he took it with him. Ronan put a fist to his forehead. He wanted to go after him and recover it, but he couldn't risk discovery. Where would he get another puzzle box? He had no way of knowing if he'd ever dream of it again. Ronan tensed. Thought about emerging, thought about hiding, thought about emerging. Matthew put a hand on his arm. They waited a long time. Finally, a car rumbled out front before receding down the driveway. They unhid themselves. Matthew pressed up against Ronan's side, reminding Ronan of Chainsaw when she was frightened. Ordinarily, Ronan would have protested, but this time he allowed it.
"What was that?" Matthew whispered.
"There are," Ronan replied, "bad things in the world. Let's get out of here." Matthew kissed his mother's cheek. Ronan made sure he had the will still tucked in his back pocket. The loss of the puzzle box still smarted, but at least he had this puzzle of his father's with him. Two lines, two languages. "What are you trying to say, Dad?" "Bye, Mom," he told Aurora. He felt in his pocket for his keys. There were two sets. The BMWs and the false Camaro's keys. See you later. 33. At that particular moment in time, Richard Campbell Gansey III was 92 miles away from his beloved car. He stood in the sun-soaked driveway of the Gansey's Washington, D.C. mansion, wearing a furiously red tie and a suit made of tasteful pinstripe and regal swagger. Beside him stood Adam, his strange and beautiful face pale above the slender dark of his own suit. Tailored by the same clever Italian man who did Gansey's shirts, the suit was Adam's silken armor for the night ahead. It was the most expensive thing he had ever owned, a month's wages translated into worsted wool. The air was humid with teriyaki and Cabernet Sauvignon and premium-grade fuel. Somewhere, a violin sang with vicious victory. It was impossibly hot. They were 97 miles and several million dollars away from Adam's childhood home. The sweeping circular driveway was a puzzle game of vehicles,
tuxedo black sedans, cello brown SUVs, silvery two-seaters that could fit in the palm of your hand, sweating white coupes with diplomatic plates. Two valets, having exhausted every parking solution, smoked cigarettes and blew smoke curls over the fenders of a Mercedes beached on the curb beside them. Rose blooms rotted on the bushes beside them, sweet and black. Gansey snaked between cars. Lucky thing we didn't have to trouble ourselves with parking. The helicopter ride still rested uneasily in Adam's stomach. He didn't care for flying or for being seen arriving in a helicopter. He'd spent 30 minutes scrubbing grease from his fingertips before they'd left. Was this the dream, or was his life back in Henrietta? He echoed, "Lucky thing." Two men and one woman stepped out of the front door of the house, hands chopped at air. Bits of the conversation exploded off the gutters overhead.
"Already been passed."
"Legislation." "Damn idiot."
"Also, his wife is a cow."
A murmur of guests passed through the open door behind them as if the threesome had pulled the sound out with them. The view through the doorway was a collage of pantsuits and pearl necklaces, Vuitton and damask. So very many, so very, very many of them. "Jesus Christ," Gansey said tragically, his eyes on the gathering. "Oh, well." He flicked an invisible piece of lint off the shoulder of Adam's suit and placed a mint leaf on his own tongue. "Good for them to see your face." Them. Somewhere in there was Gansey's mother, stretching her hands out to the hungry D.C. off-the-rack suit crowd, offering them treasure in heaven in return for votes. And Gansey was part of the sales package. There was nothing more congressional than the entire Gansey family under one roof. Because those dripping necklaces and red ties were the captivated retinue who would fund Mrs. Richard Gansey II's run for office. And those shiny Oxfords and velvet pumps were the nobles Adam sought squireship from. "Good for them to see your face." A laugh, high and confident, pierced the air. Conversation swelled to accept it. "Who are these people," Adam thought, "to think they know anything about the rest of the world?" He must not let it show in his eyes. If he reminded himself that he needed them, these people. If he reminded himself it was only a means to an end, it was a little easier. Besides, Adam was good at hiding things. Gansey greeted the guests standing outside the door. Despite his previous complaint, he was completely at ease, a lion in the Serengeti. "In we go," he said grandly, and just like that, the Gansey who Adam had befriended, the Gansey he would do anything for, vanished, and in his place was the heir, born with a silk umbilical cord wrapped around his blue-blooded neck. The Gansey mansion spread out before them. There was Helen, now deliberately effete and decidedly unattainable in a black sheath, her legs longer than the driveway. "What shall we toast to?" "Toast to me, of course. Oh yes, my mother too." There was ex-Congressman Bullock, and there was the head of the Van Scholing Committee, and there were Mr. and Mrs. John Binderham, the largest single donors to the last 8th District Republican campaign. Everywhere were faces Adam had seen in newspapers and on television. Everything smelled of puff pastry and ambition. 17 years before, Adam had been born in a trailer. They could see it on him. He knew it.
"What are you two handsome devils up to?"
Gansey laughed. "Ha ha ha." Adam turned, but the speaker was already gone. Someone grabbed Gansey's hand. "Dick, good to see you." The unseen violin wailed. The acoustics gave the impression the instrument was imprisoned in the Chesterfield by the door. A man in a white shirt pressed champagne flutes into their hands. It was ginger ale, sweet and fraudulent. A hand slapped to the back of Adam's neck. He flinched badly. In his head, he fell down his father's stairs, fingers grabbing dirt. He could never seem to leave Henrietta behind. He could feel an image, an apparition looming behind his eyes, but he pushed it away.
Not here. Not now.
We always need young blood, boomed the man.
Adam was sweating, flipping between the memory of biting stars overhead, the fact of this present-day assault.
Gansey took the man's hand from Adam's neck and shook it instead. Adam knew he was being rescued, but the room was too loud and too close for gratitude.
Gansey said, "We're young as they come."
"You're pretty damn young," the man said.
"This is Adam Parrish," Gansey said. "Shake his hand. He's more clever than I am. One day we'll be throwing one of these shindigs for him."
Somehow Adam had a business card pressed into his hand. Someone else gave him more ginger ale.
No, this one was actually champagne. Adam did not drink alcohol.
Gansey smoothly took the champagne flute from him and placed it on an antique desk with ivory inlay. With a finger, he slicked off a single drop of red wine that stained the surface. Voices wrestled with one another. The deepest voice won.
8 months ago, we were in the same place as this on that campaign,
a man with an enormous tie pin said to a man with an enormously shiny forehead.
Sometimes you just throw funds at it and hope it sticks.
Gansey shook hands and clasped shoulders. He talked women into confessing their names and then made them believe that he'd known them all along. He always called Adam, Adam Parrish. Everyone always called him Dick. Adam gathered a bouquet of business cards. His hips smashed into a piece of lion-pawed furniture. Irish crystal jingled from the lamp sitting on it. A spirit touched his elbow. Not here. Not now.
Having fun? Gansey asked. It did not sound as if he was, but his smile was bulletproof.
His eyes roved the room as he knocked back his ginger ale or his champagne. He accepted another flute from a faceless serving tray. They moved to the next person, and the next. 10, 15, 20 people in, and Gansey was an embroidered tapestry of a young man, the hoped-for youth of America, the educated princeling son of Mrs. Richard Gansey II. The room adored him. Adam wondered if there was a true smile among this herd of wealthy animals.
Dick, finally, do you have the keys to the Fiat?
Helen came close to them, eye to eye with Gansey in a pair of black pumps that were sensible on every other woman in the room and unreasonably sexy on her. She was, Adam thought, the sort of woman Declan was always trying to obtain, not realizing that Helen was not the obtainable sort. You could love the sleek, efficient beauty of a brand new bullet train, but only a fool could imagine it would love you back.
"Why would I?" Gansey asked.
"Oh, I don't know. Every car is blocked in except that one, those idiot valets." She tipped her head back and looked at the tree-painted ceiling. To Adam, the intricate branches seemed to be moving.
"Mom wants me to do a booze run. If you come with, I can use the HOV lanes and not spend the rest of my life getting wine."
She noticed Adam.
"Oh, Parrish, you clean up well."
She meant nothing by it, nothing at all, but Adam felt an ice chip pierce his heart.
"Helen," Gansey said,
"shut up."
"It's a compliment," Helen said.
A server replaced their empty drinks with full ones.
"Remember why you're here. Get in, get what you need, get out. You're not one of them."
Adam said evenly, flattening his accent,
"It's all right."
"I meant that you two were always in your school uniforms," Helen said. "Not like, shut up, Helen," Gansey said.
"Don't PMS on me," Helen replied, "just because you wish you were with your beloved Henrietta."
A fleeting expression passed across Gansey's face then. She'd guessed right. It was killing him to be here.
"Why is it again you didn't bring the other one?" Helen asked.
But before Gansey could reply, someone else caught her eye and she allowed herself to be swept away as swiftly as she'd appeared.
"What a dreadful thought," Gansey observed suddenly, "Ronan among this crowd."
For a fleeting moment, Adam could imagine it, the brocade curtains in decaying flames, the decorated consorts screaming from beneath the harpsichord, Ronan standing among it all saying, "Fuck Washington."
Gansey said, "Ready for the next round?"
The evening would never end, but Adam kept watching. He swallowed his ginger ale. He wasn't sure it hadn't actually been champagne now all along.
The party had become a devil's feast. Will-o'-the-wisps caught in brass hunting lamps. Impossibly bright meats presented on ivy filigreed platters. Men in black. Women jeweled in green and red. The painted trees of the ceiling bent low overhead. Adam was wired and exhausted here and somewhere else. Nothing was real but him and Gansey. Before them was a woman who had just spoken with Gansey's mother. Everyone who caught Gansey had either just conversed with his mother, or just shook her hand, or just glimpsed her moving between the dark-clad partygoers. It was an elaborate political play where his mother played a beloved but rare wraith. Although everyone recalled seeing her, no one could actually locate her at the moment of recollection. "You have," the woman said to Gansey, "grown so much since the last time I've seen you. You must be nearly." And at that, at the moment of guessing Gansey's age, she hesitated. Adam knew that she had sensed that otherness to his friend, that sense that Gansey was both young and old, that he'd only just arrived, or he'd always been. She was saved by a glance at Adam. Quickly assessing his age, she finished, 17? 18?
17, ma'am, Gansey said warmly, and he was as soon as he'd said it. Of course he was 17 and nothing else. Something like relief passed over the woman's face. Adam felt the press of the candied tree branches overhead. To his right, he caught a half-image of himself in a gold-framed mirror and startled. For a moment, his reflection had seemed wrong. It was happening.
No, no. It's not happening. Not here. Not now. A second glance revealed a clearer image. Nothing strange. Yet.
Did I read in the paper that you're still looking for those crown jewels? The woman asked Gansey.
Oh, I'm looking for an actual king, Gansey said, speaking loudly to be heard over the violin. There were three of them, actually. The last man had informed him that they were students from Peabody. The strings wavered as if the sound came from underwater. A Welsh king from the 15th century. The woman laughed delightedly. She'd misheard Gansey and thought he'd made a joke. Gansey laughed too, as if he had, and any awkwardness that might have arisen was swiftly averted. Adam made a note of that. And now, finally, there was Mrs. Gansey looming at the corner of his vision like a materialized dream. Like Gansey himself, she was intrinsically beautiful in the way that only someone who has always had money can be. It seemed right that an entire party should be thrown in her honor. She was a worthy queen for the evening.
Gloria, Mrs. Gansey said to the woman, I love that necklace. You, of course, remember my son, Dick.
Of course, Gloria said. He is so very tall.
You must be off to college soon.
Both women turned for his answer. Violins shrilled up the scale. Well, it... And then all at once Gansey faltered. It was not quite a full stop, just a failure to slide smoothly from moment to moment. There was only time enough for Adam to see the gap, and then Gansey said,
I'm sorry. I thought I saw someone.
Adam caught his eye. There was a question there, unspoken. Gansey's return gaze was complicated. No, he was not all right, but no, there was nothing Adam could do about it. Adam had a brief, ferocious joy that they could get to Gansey as well. How he hated them.
Oh, I do see someone. I must leave you, Gansey said, impeccably polite. I'm sorry, but I'll leave you with... Mrs. Elgin, this is my friend Adam Parrish. He has interesting thoughts about travelers' rights. Have you thought about travelers' rights lately?
Adam tried to remember the last time he and Gansey had spoken about travelers' rights. He was pretty sure the entire discussion had taken place over a lukewarm pizza, and it had something to do with the body scanners microwaving the brain cells of frequent flyers. But now that he'd seen Gansey at work, he knew Gansey would spool that out into a political epidemic solvable by his mother.
I haven't, Gloria Elgin replied, dazzled by Gansey's Ganseyness.
We usually take Ben Cessna these days, but I would like to hear about it.
When she turned to Adam, Gansey vanished into the crowd. For a moment, Adam said nothing. He was not Gansey. He did not dazzle. He was a pretender with a flute of false champagne in his slender hand, made from dust. He looked at Mrs. Elgin. She looked back at him through her eyelashes. With a jolt, he realized that he intimidated her. Standing there in his impervious suit, with its red knotted tie, young and straight-shouldered and clean, he had pulled off whatever strange alchemy Gansey performed. For perhaps the first time in his life, someone was looking at him and seeing power. He tried to conjure up the magic he'd already seen Gansey do this evening. His mind swam with the noise of this glittering company, the shimmer in the bottom of his champagne glass, the knowledge that this was the future if he speared it. He was in a forest. Whispers pursued him. "Not here," he said. "Can I refill your drink first?" Mrs. Elgin's face melted with pleasure as she offered up her glass. "Don't you know?" Adam wondered. He at least could still smell diesel fuel on his hands. "Don't you know what I am?" But this flock of peacocks was too busy fooling to notice they were being fooled. Adam couldn't remember why he was here. He was dissolving in a hallucination of ghostly guests alongside the real ones. "Because this is Aglenby," he thought, desperately trying to ground himself. "This is what happens to Aglenby in the real world. This is how you use that education you've worked so hard for. This is how you get out." Suddenly, an electric buzz groaned through the room. The lights dipped and crackled. The clinking of glasses paused as the lamps swelled once more, and then the lights went out entirely. Was this real? Not now. The sun had set, and the interior of the house was close and dark brown around the guests. The windows were unfocused squares of gray streetlight. Scents seemed strangely pronounced. Lilac and carpet cleaner, cinnamon and mold. The room was full of the wordless shuffle of a stockyard. And in that brief pause in the conversation, in that shocked silence filled with neither the hum of voices nor of electronics, a high song floated through the dark. A precise, archaic melody sung by a chorus of women's voices, pure and thin, spreading from a thread of sound to a river of one. It took only a moment for Adam to realize that the words were not in English. "Rex corvus, parate, regis, corvi." Adam felt charged from his feet to his fingertips. Somewhere in this darkness, Gansey was hearing this too. Adam could sense him hearing it. These voices were true in a way that nothing else had been that day. Adam remembered all at once what it felt like to feel, to be real, to be Adam, instead of "my friend Adam Parrish, give him your card." He couldn't believe what a huge difference there was between those two things. The lights surged back on. Conversation collapsed back into place. Some part of Adam was still lodged back there in the dark. "Was that Spanish?" Gloria Elgin asked, her hand pressed to her throat. Adam could see the line of her makeup on her jaw. "Latin," Adam said, trying to find Gansey's face in the crowd. His pulse still galloped. It was Latin. "The Raven King. Make way for the Raven King." "What a funny thing," said Gloria Elgin. "Owen Glendower was the Raven King. There were so many stories of Glendower knowing the language of birds. So many stories of ravens whispering secrets to him." "Probably a brownout," Adam replied. The business cards in his pocket felt irrelevant. He was still searching for the only pair of eyes in the room that mattered. Where was Gansey? "Everyone's air conditioning on at the same time." "That's probably true," Gloria Elgin said, comforted. The conversation around them muttered, "Peabody kids have a funny sense of humor."
I'll have another of the shrimp things. What were you saying?
What did you do when the marble was cracked?
There, across the room, was Gansey. His gaze seized Adams and held it. Even though the lights were back on, the voices long dissipated, Adam could still sense the power of the newly wakened ley line surging beneath him all the way back to Henrietta. This glittering host had already moved on, but not Adam, not Gansey. They were the only two living things in this room.
Do you see? Adam felt like shouting. This is why I made the sacrifice.
This was how he would find Glendower.
34. The inside of the old Camaro smelled like asphalt and desire, gasoline and dreams. Ronan sat behind the wheel, eyes on the midnight street. Streetlights fenced the asphalt, slashing reflections over the atomic orange hood. On either side of the road, the barren lots of car dealerships sprawled, eerie and silent. He was as hungry as the night. The color of the dash turned green-yellow-red under the traffic light above. In the cracked passenger-side mirror, Noah appeared anxious. He checked over his shoulder for cops. Ronan checked his teeth. "Nice to see you, Noah," he said. He could feel every pump of his heart, every surge through his veins. "Been a while." "I did this," Ronan thought. The keys trembled against one another in the ignition. "I made this happen." Kavinsky was late, as always. Time, as he liked to say, was money, and though he had plenty of both, he enjoyed the thieving nonetheless. "I've been trying," Noah said. He added, "I don't want to watch you die." Without answering, Ronan rubbed a thumb over the worn numbers on the gear shift. The engine pounded his shoes through the pedals. If anything about the Camaro had been built for comfort, those features had been worn away by 40 years of use. The small of his back was sticky against the cracked vinyl seat. The clock didn't work, but the tachometer did. The reluctant sigh of air through the vents was feeble, but the crash of the pistons was anything but. The engine was the loudest concert in the world, slowly thrashing itself to pieces under the hood. The speedometer was numbered all the way up to 140. That was insanity. The car felt dangerous, and it felt fast. "I'll get Gansey," Noah threatened. "I don't think you can."
"How long till Kavinsky gets here?"
"Noah," Ronan said tenderly, placing his palm on top of Noah's cold, 7 years dead hand, "you're starting to piss me off." Headlights sliced across the rearview mirror. 17 minutes after he was due, Kavinsky arrived. In the rearview mirror, Ronan watched a white Mitsubishi slow as it pulled up. Its black mouth yawned. The gritty knife on the side was identical to Kavinsky's previous car. The Mitsubishi pulled up alongside the Camaro. The passenger window rolled down. Kavinsky wore his white-rimmed sunglasses.
"Lynch, you bastard," he said by way of greeting.
He didn't acknowledge Noah. He probably couldn't see him. Ronan rolled his wrist to flip his middle finger at Kavinsky. Muscle memory. Kavinsky appraised the pig.
"I'm impressed."
"I dreamt this," Ronan wanted to shout it. But instead he jerked his chin at the Mitsubishi. It was hard to believe that it was real. He had just seen the last one burning from the inside out. Kavinsky must have run out and replaced it the very next morning. And the graphic? Maybe he'd done it himself, though it was hard to imagine Kavinsky really devoting time to anything that wasn't powdered. Ronan said, "That makes one of us."
"Oh, this one's got a bit more going on. You don't like it?"
On the gear shift, Ronan's hand shivered a little. More headlights glittered across the mirrors, Kavinsky's pack of dogs. Their faces were anonymous behind dark-tinted windows, but Ronan knew the cars. Jiang's Supra, Skov's RX-7, Swan's and Prokopenko's matching Golfs. He'd beaten them all before.
"Brought the whole family," Ronan observed. In a few minutes, they'd all dispersed to look out for cops. First glimpse of a radar and Kavinsky would be warned off, gone before the asphalt had cooled.
"You know me," Kavinsky said warmly. "I just hate to be alone."
"So,"
Are you gonna fuck that old lady you're in, or are you just gonna hold her hand?
Ronan raised his eyebrow. Noah said, Ronan, don't. Gansey'll kill you. Ronan.
Through the open window, Ronan asked evenly,
You gonna race with those shades on, you Bulgarian mobster jersey trash piece of shit?
Kavinsky nodded slowly through the question as if he agreed, scratching his wrist on the top of his steering wheel. He looked very tired or very bored as he replied,
What I can never figure out.
The traffic light flicked to red, turning his tinted lenses crimson.
Is if you, or Gansey, is on top.
Something black simmered inside Ronan, slow and ugly. His voice was cyanide and kerosene as he said,
What's going to happen is, I'm going to beat that car, and then I'm going to get out of this car, and then I'm going to beat the shit out of you.
320 horses, say you're wrong, man.
Kavinsky touched his neck. He wore a white tank, and his exposed shoulder was raw and beautiful as a corpse.
But keep dreaming.
His window slid back up. Barely visible through the asphalt black tint, Kavinsky tossed his sunglasses onto the passenger seat. The whole world was now the traffic lights above the two cars.
Ronan, Noah said, I have a super bad feeling.
It's called being dead, Ronan replied.
That's the sort of joke that's only funny if you're alive.
Good thing I am.
For now.
Wait for the green.
Ronan's eyes were not on the traffic light overhead, but on the light on the opposing street. When it turned yellow, he had 2 seconds to get off the line.
Ronan eased his foot off the clutch, pressed down on the gas, held the car in check. The tack quivered just below the red line. The engine was alive, snarling, rattling. The sound replaced Ronan's pulse. Smoke from the rear tires crept from beneath the car and into the still open windows. Kavinsky's Mitsubishi was barely audible over the howl of the pig. For a single second, Ronan allowed himself to think of his father and the barns and his dreams stretching out before him full of impossible things. He allowed himself to think of the part of himself that was a bomb, the wick burning fast and destructive, nearly gone. The opposing light was still solid green. The traffic light overhead was red as a warning. Want was eating him alive. The opposing traffic light went yellow. 1 second, he slid his foot farther off the clutch. 1 second, the gear shift knob sweated beneath his palm. Green. The cars burst from the line. It was growl, 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 and this, strangely audible, Kavinsky's primal laugh. Shift. Immediately, the Mitsubishi was nearly a length ahead. On either side of the street lights flickered and flared, measuring out life in epileptic bursts of light. Flash. Cracked asphalt. Flash. Aglenby's sticker on the dashboard. Flash. Noah's widened eyes. They were bodies electric. The Camaro caught the Mitsubishi in the second half just as Ronan had expected. The engine raged at the top of second gear, and there was, crouched somewhere between second and third gear, somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 RPMs, there was pure joy. Screaming along with the thousands of tiny explosions beneath the hood was a place where Ronan felt nothing but uncomplicated happiness, a dead and empty place in his heart where he needed nothing else. Beside them, the Mitsubishi sagged. Kavinsky had buggered the shift from third to fourth like he always did. Ronan did not. Shift. The engine roared anew. The car was Gansey's religion, and Ronan found it a worthy god. Its slender hood nosed ahead of the Mitsubishi, put a length between them, another half. It was nothing but up from here. There was nothing inside Ronan. Glorious nothing. And behind that, more nothing. But something was wrong. Kavinsky's window rolled down. He craned his head to meet Ronan's gaze in the rearview mirror, and he shouted something. The words were lost in the noise, but their meaning was visible. Teeth bared for a k, and then lips pursed. Ooh! Spat in a joyful curse. The Mitsubishi exploded away from the Camaro. The streetlights snaked over the black windows, winking off and on across the widened gap. It wasn't possible. Ronan grabbed another gear, the only one left. The gas pedal crouched against the floor. Everything in the vehicle was shaking itself apart. The Mitsubishi was still pulling away. Kavinsky's hand extended, middle finger waving. Noah shouted, "Impossible!" Ronan knew the numbers. He'd ridden in a Camaro. He knew Kavinsky's car. He'd beaten Kavinsky's car. Feeling was coming back to him like blood into a numb limb, stabbing him in fits and starts. White as a fang, the Mitsubishi careened into the darkness in front of them. It was the sort of fast that didn't belong to cars. It was the sort of fast that wasn't a speed, it was a distance. Like a plane was here, and then it was there in a moment. A comet was on this side of the sky, and then the other. The Mitsubishi was beside the Camaro, and then it wasn't. It was so far gone into victory that the only engine note left was the Camaro's. Sparks rained down from the streetlights.